Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of September 20th, 2013. The American Dream. What does that even mean now, anyway? We spent the past few weeks trying to figure it out and asking people about their dreams. For most of us, it's still about mobility, getting educated, making a home, taking care of your family, and retiring comfortably. A slew of experts helped us build a financial roadmap of sorts, from where you are now to where you want to be.
First-time homeowners are always surprised at how expensive it is to own a piece of property. When you're considering purchasing, ask the current homeowner for his or her utility bills, his or her property tax bills.
What patients can do is ask about whether anesthesiology is included in that. What I saw from a number of patient bills was the big charge was for the anesthesiologist to who put you under.
Retirement savings, how much you need, it doesn't depend on your income. It's a multiple of your spending. And it turns out you need about 25 times your annual spending saved up, and then you can quit working forever.
The good thing about the 529 is they have total flexibility. People in any state can invest in them. So one good strategy that a lot of grandparents ask me about is if the parents live in one state and their state offers a tax deduction, but say the grandparents live in a different state, they'll get a tax break themselves because there's no limit to the number of different plans that a child can have.
Saving for college, home ownership, retirement. Those are what you might call personal finance dreams. But guess what? Big picture policy decisions shape how you pay for those things. Most of those decisions are made at the Federal Reserve. You may have heard about the nomination process for the next Fed chair. Ben Bernanke has been the chairman since 2006, and his term expires in January. The debate over who should replace him has been messy. But we're putting that aside right now to explain why what happens at the Fed makes a big difference in your financial life. Anne Owen is an economics professor at Hamilton College, and she was also an economist at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
So I have to confess, before I started covering economics, I would tune out at any story that talked about the Federal Reserve or who was the chairman or who was going to be. For people who have been doing that the past couple of weeks, will you translate why they should pay attention?
The Fed can have a pretty important effect on the economy that would affect individuals in many different ways. For example, the Fed influences interest rates, and those interest rates can influence loan rates that people pay, can influence whether or not it's a good idea to refinance your mortgage. It can influence rates of returns you might be getting on savings. So it could have a big effect on pretty much everybody.
And really, what it seems to do is, and I know this sounds counterintuitive, but make money itself less expensive.
Well, that's exactly right, right? One way to think about the interest rate is that, well, the interest rate is the price of money. Basically, what the Fed is doing is they're putting a very large supply of money out in the economy. And when you have a large supply, it lowers the price. So it lowers the interest rate.
Well, let's take one of those pieces and break it down. So, say a mortgage. If I'm thinking about buying a house right now, or I've got a mortgage, how does what the Federal Reserve and what they decide in Washington, how does that impact me?
Well, what the Federal Reserve is actively doing is trying to keep interest rates low, especially actually mortgage rates. And the reason why they want to do that is because they want to keep housing prices increasing, because that's generally good for the economy.
One of the things that we've covered at Marketplace and Marketplace Money is this question of quantitative easing. That's the fancy term for the Fed buying a lot of bonds. How does that affect what everyday people see and what they buy?
Right. So what quantitative easing is really, again, this idea that the Fed is putting a lot of money into the economy, with the idea being that the interest rate is the price of money. So they're trying to lower that interest rate. What quantitative easing is the Fed is purchasing treasury securities, and they're also purchasing mortgage securities. They are trying to have an effect on the longer-term rates, such as mortgage rates, and that will lower loans for things like houses and cars and other types of long-term kind of purchases that people make.
When I think about my wallet and personal finance, I'm mostly thinking about I go to the bank, I pay my bills, but my bank is actually overseen by the Fed. What do they do as a bank regulator?
The Fed has a lot of responsibility to regulate banks and to oversee the financial system. So when the Fed regulates banks, they will actually send examiners into the bank to make sure that the bank is evaluating loans and other decisions that it might make appropriately.
A lot of people look at, say, their savings account and what's been kind of a measly interest rate over the last few years because of those low rates set by the Fed. Is that ever going to change, do you think?
Well, I do think eventually interest rates are going to go up. When people look at their savings accounts, you have to be careful that when you look at that interest rate that you're getting, that you subtract from that interest rate the inflation rate, because that's really what you're earning. And it's true that even when you do that, the number is very low. It's actually probably negative right now. And one of the reasons why interest rates are so low right now is because inflation is very low. So I think that eventually those rates will go up, but so will inflation.
Anne Owen is a former economist for the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, and she's a professor of economics at Hamilton College. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. As Professor Owen just pointed out, there's a direct line between the Federal Reserve and your wallet. What you might pay for a car loan or a mortgage, how much things cost, and thus how far your income goes. We got a big report this past week about incomes. The Census gave us its annual snapshot on household incomes and poverty. Guess what? Not a lot's changed since 2011. Jolie Myers is a producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk, and she's been looking at the numbers. Hey, Jolie.
Hey, Lizzie.
Tell me about what we learned in the census this week.
Well, we found out the median income for the U.S. stayed the same, about 51 grand a year, and the poverty rate held steady as well. 15% of Americans live in poverty. And in this case, no news was not good news. A lot of the economists I talked to before the numbers came out were really expecting median income to tick up and poverty to tick down because it's from 2012. These numbers are from 2012, which is after the recession, you'll remember.
Technically ended.
Technically. But that was the reaction. What recovery if median income is not ticking up and poverty is not going down?
You guys have been playing with this question of income on the Wealth and Poverty desk and put together something kind of cool. Explain it to me.
Right. So on the Wealth and Poverty desk, we came up with this new data interactive. It's called Income Upshot. And we used a ton of different data from the census, marketing research firms, academic researchers, and measured a bunch of relationships between what we make, our incomes, and how we live, work, and play. And we actually took the game out into Los Angeles and had people on the streets give it a whirl. First, we asked them to enter their incomes.
I'm putting $30,000 as a yearly income.
And what's your zip code?
91325.
An income of $30,000 a year is $15,560 below the median.
The majority of people making this much own their homes. Okay, we rent. So we are with the 19.4% that rent.
Most common commute time is 0 minutes. I don't know how to take that. I do work a lot from home.
So your commute time is from your bed to the coffee maker.
Yeah, no, this is really interesting. I would definitely go back and play with it and put in zip codes I used to live in.
So those are people's responses. Explain a little bit about how this calculates stuff and what the stuff is.
As you heard, you put in your income level or any income level, really, and a zip code, whether that's yours or somebody else's, a place you used to live. The first thing you're going to find out is how you stack up by income to your neighbors. It'll tell you how much more you make than the median in your zip code. You'll also find out how you fit into the national picture when it comes to income. And we have marriage rates by income. We have favorite car purchases by income. Now, Lizzie, do you want to give it a try?
I tried it. It got a couple of things right. I am a wine drinker, generally, not a beer drinker. I do prefer dogs. But I also live in Brooklyn, so I suspect that I'm an outlier here.
Yeah, you know, when you look at big cities like L.A. and where I am and New York, where you are, the cost of living there, it doesn't really match up with the rest of America. So when I look at the home ownership rate for my income level, it makes me laugh out loud. I could never afford a home in Los Angeles right now. But, you know, it's a lot of these numbers are for the national picture, so you're going to have outliers.
So I asked some of my Twitter followers to play, and mm-hmm. they did. The thing that seems to have people the most interested, maybe this says more about my Twitter followers than anything else, is where Americans break on wine versus beer.
It's very controversial, Lizzie.
They're really focused on that. What did you find out, and what are some of the other weird things that are in there?
There's actually a lot of really, really fun stuff in there. For instance, the income bracket that prefers gerbils the most as pets, $85,000 to $99,999 a year. Those are the gerbil owners. It's peak gerbil. And I think that the liquor one, though, was my favorite. No income level prefers liquor to beer or wine. And my response to that is, why do we have to pick?
That is a good response. Wealth and Poverty producer Jolie Myers, I'm going to give you a chance. Plug it now. Where should people go?
Head over to marketplace.org and click on Income Upshot.
Thanks, Jolie.
Thank you.
Next, you've maxed out your IRA contributions and you're wondering, what should you do next?
What may be most logical for you at this time is index funds and have a nice, boring portfolio.
The joys of plain vanilla investing with no high fees. That's ahead on Marketplace Money from APM. Following up on our shows about the American dream and what it means to you now. Listeners have written us a ton of letters over the past month about buying a house, paying for college, retirement, and the cost of getting sick. We wanted to answer some of the questions we've gotten during our series, so I'm joined by Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst and a familiar voice on this show. Very nice to have you back, Jill.
Great to be with you.
All right. So our first caller is Melanie, and she's in Manchester, Connecticut. Hey, Melanie.
Hi.
I gather we've confused you.
Yes. So I'm an avid listener to the podcast. And so that always means that I listen to about, you know, anywhere from like 5 to 7 podcasts within a few days.
Good. We love you.
Oh, okay. And so basically what it is I was listening to a podcast and there's a lady on there whose daughter is going to University of Maryland and that she has paid out of pocket for her daughter's whole entire education. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. You know, and her bill, whole big thing is, okay, you need to not have any debt, like carry any debt whatsoever. And I'm like, okay, that's not realistic for me. And then you have another contributor on here who's like, okay, it's all about retirement. You need to save for retirement. You know, don't worry about your student loans. You'll pay them off when you pay them off. So my question is we have a little bit of a nest egg, and we're going to start a family. But the question is do we pay off student loans? Do we talk with a financial planner about this nest egg? Or do we just keep what it's doing right now, which is sitting in our checking account and doing nothing?
Well, first, I have a couple of questions for you, which is how old you are, what you and your husband or partner do, and how much debt you have and how much you're making.
Gotcha. Okay. Both my husband and I are 34 years old. The only debt we have are my student loans. His student loans have been paid in full. I have student loans from my first bachelor's degree and student loans from my second associate's degree.
How much is the total amount of student loan debt right now?
Okay, so it's $55,000 and it's all mine.
And the interest rate of that debt?
The interest rate on one of them is 4.5%. And the other one is varied for anything from 3.5 to 6.5.
And how much was the nest egg?
Nest egg we have is $25,000.
Sweet. How much do you guys make together?
Our combined income after taxes is a little bit over $100,000.
That's awesome. We're liking that.
Yeah.
It's good numbers.
So I suspect Jill has some thoughts for you and your dilemma. Go for it.
Yeah. So my first thought is that the answer to who's right between those two podcast advisees would be yes. OK. And the reason is that it's hard to give across the board advice to people. Oh, you have to have all your debt paid off before you can pay into your retirement, because every situation is unique and yours is unique as well. If I put my financial planner hat on and, you know, I did pass that CFP test, Lizzie, and I'm never giving it up. I would pay down some of the higher interest student loan debt first. So, you know, the 6.5 down to 4.5, I'd be psyched if you could pay that off. But if you could also swing at the same time, putting some minimum amount away into retirement, especially if either you or your husband has a match available to you, I almost would say, yes, I would prefer it if you guys could do a little bit of both. I wouldn't be in a huge rush to pay off a 3.5% loan. But to me, 6.5%, if I'm thinking about what I could do with my money, I'd like a guaranteed return of 6.5%. And that's what you're getting when you pay off a 6.5% loan. So do you guys have match opportunities from your employers?
Yes, and that's the thing is I work part-time, he works full-time. He's contributing the max amount that he can match, and I'm contributing the max amount that I can get matched.
I think that's great.
So the question is do we contribute more, or do we talk with like a financial planner about investing, or do we, like, it's sort of like, what do we do?
If I were your financial planner, and I used to play one, I would say you don't really need to go to a financial planner, and you don't need – I mean, the reality is that there's only a limited amount of resources you have. It may seem tempting to take your nest egg and to pop it down and get rid of a whole bunch of debt at once, but that leaves you without an emergency reserve fund, and that's kind of freaky to me. I mean, one of the things that we learned, you know, now 5 years after the financial crisis is people who had those nice nest eggs were really happy to have them. So I wouldn't presume to say dive into the nest egg and deplete it. I would continue to do what you're doing currently, which is use your retirement plans, put up to the match in, and clock down your student loan debt, highest interest to lowest interest. And I might stop short at the 3.5 or 4% notes, but I would really want to pay that off. And I think there's nothing better than getting a risk-free return.
You mentioned that the student loan debt, $55,000, is in your name. How do you and your husband talk about that debt? And do you pay it on your own, or does he contribute as well?
Well, he's the primary income earner. Let's put it that way. He works full-time. I work part-time. So the way it's sort of talked about is we have a joint checking account, and we combined everything, and it all comes out of that. So his debt was my debt when he had his student loans, and my debt is now his debt.
Seems fair.
All right, Melanie, I hope this is helpful to you, and keep us posted, okay? Let us know what happens.
Okay, I appreciate this. Thank you. It does. It helps me to think further on some other endeavors.
Thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you.
Jill, we have another caller now, Jennifer from Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Jennifer, tell us about your situation.
Hi, thanks so much. So I'm calling today because my husband and I are having a little bit of trouble figuring out what to do with some of our retirement money. So specifically, my husband was self-employed for a long time, and so we opened a solo 401k for him and have been contributing the max to that for a couple years. But in the middle of this year, he decided to become an employee, So we're looking ahead to next year. Now that he's employed, we can no longer contribute to the solo 401k. And his new company is a small business, and they have no retirement plan at all. So they don't offer a 401k. So we're kind of curious about what should we do with all of this money that we used to contribute to the solo 401k. We are already maxing out my 403b and maxing out both of our Roth IRAs.
And how old are you guys, and what do you do?
So we're in our early 30s. My husband is an engineer, and I'm a professor.
Dare I ask where in Providence you are a professor?
A little school, a great school called Providence College.
Very nice. She's a friar.
I am
so
a friar.
I happen to go to college across town on College Hill, so I have great respect for the friars. They used to kick our butts in every sporting event possible.
Jill, what do you think?
You know, this is a very hard question because for those of you listening, you probably don't even know that there's this thing called a solo 401k. So when you're self-employed or you have your own small business, you can not just put away what you would put away in a regular 401k, $17,500, you can put up to $56,500 if you're over the age of 50. So going from being able to put $51,000 in Jennifer's husband's case to zero is massive. The problem is there's not a great solution for you. You're already maxing the Roth IRA, so $5,500 each. Now you're left with, okay, any other way to do it on a tax advantage basis? Anything cool I can do here?
Yeah.
No. That's the problem. The answer is that you've got two big choices. Some insurance salesman is going to tell you, I have a brilliant idea. You should buy an insurance product. You should either buy some sort of permanent life insurance and plow tons of money in there, or you should buy an annuity product, which would allow you to invest on a tax-deferred basis, and that will be a fabulous idea for you. It's also a very expensive way to do your investing. So what may be most logical for you at this time is something that's probably counterintuitive, which is you might just want to invest an after-tax dollar in either a mutual fund company or at a brokerage company where you could buy index funds and have a nice, boring portfolio. It's after-tax dollars. You probably have plowed a lot of money into your retirement accounts already. How much money do you have in his solo 401k and your 403b at this point?
So including everything, even including the Roths, we're at somewhere like $125,000, maybe a little bit more.
You know, what you'd obviously want to do is for your husband to sort of gently nudge the company to say, hey, come on, it's so cheap to put in a retirement plan now. There's so many great ways we can do it. We could do a simple plan. We could do a lot of different things that don't have to cost a lot of money. But short of the employer stepping up to the plate, you're kind of left with the rotten world of a very heavy fee-based insurance product, or I got to pay my taxes and basically invest in a after-tax account. I'll label it a retirement account filled with hopefully really cheap index funds.
Yeah.
I also just had a producer hop in my ear and tell me that you had let me put it this way, a new financial responsibility arrived 7 weeks ago?
I do. I have a 7-week-old daughter, our first.
Congratulations.
And that's the other thing. So as soon as we got her Social Security number, we did open up already two college accounts for her, a Coverdale, which we maxed out, and then also a 529, which we put a chunk of change in. So we could always put more money in that.
Man, you're on top of it.
Yeah, I'll say.
Yeah, you have a lucky daughter.
Wow. I mean, I think you're in fantastic shape. And, you know, when people always ask me this question about, like, should I maximize retirement or should I do this or should I do this? You know, especially in your 30s and your 40s, you've got a lot of needs. So I think it's great to be able to do a little bit of everything. And it sounds like you're fortunate enough to be able to do that.
And I have to say, you sound remarkably with it for someone with a 7-week-old child.
I get lucked out. I got a very, very easy baby.
Well, congratulations, and thank you so much for calling.
Thank you both for your help. I really appreciate it.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Jill Schlesinger is my guest this hour. She is a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. We have another question from another Jennifer, who is also in Providence, Rhode Island. I am not making this up. Two Jennifers, both in Providence. Jennifer, we just had a caller with your same name and location.
I heard. Our name and location is probably the only thing we have in common. I'm not going to get such glowing reviews, I think, for being in such good shape.
Oh, please. Tell us your story.
Okay. Well, very briefly, for a variety of reasons, I got a very late start to my financial life, to the point where I am now 50 years old, and I've only been working full-time for 7 years. In those 7 years, I've really worked hard, and I've basically overcome a bankruptcy. I've started finally a 401k, which I now have about $101,000 in, and I have savings for the first time in my life at about $14,000, and I'm saving about $600 a month. So my question is, you know, I'm certainly not struggling, but at the same time, I like to feel like I am saving for a down payment for a house, but I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to do it. I have a partner, and she is an underemployed academic. She's actually trying to switch careers at this point because there are so few academic jobs in the humanities. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really have much savings. So I'm not quite sure whether I really can consider this a down payment for a house when it really should be my emergency fund, you know, and I probably should be putting more in my 401k if I want to retire before I'm like 90.
We're going to get you there at 88. Don't worry.
Can I ask you, what's your retirement goal? How long do you plan on working?
I would love to be able to retire, you know, before 70. I think that would be very nice.
Where are you living now?
I live in Providence. I work in Boston, so I take, you know, the train an hour and a half each way. This in Providence, sort of not the greatest area. There is absolutely no place to sit outside. And, like, you know, the drug dealers are around the corner, but I'm getting it at a very low rate. So it's maximizing my savings.
What's the rent?
The rent is $625 a month.
Oh, goodness gracious.
I know. You know, in part because I am the caretaker of the house. It's one of those triple-decker houses, mm-hmm. which you probably are familiar with in Providence. The landlord lives in Missouri, so I take care of it for him and get a discount on rent. But even without the discount, it's still ridiculously cheap.
It's hard for me to get so enthusiastic about the house thing. It sounds like you've got such a great deal. So number one is it's going to be hard for you to replicate that kind of low-cost living arrangement. But even so, let's presume that you really do want a house. And there's no reason why you shouldn't say, well, I could at least have a goal of a house. I mean, it doesn't mean it has to happen.
Right.
But, you know, I'd like to keep my options open. And the way that you would keep your options open is that $14,000 that you have in savings, you just keep contributing
right.
to it and keep letting
right.
that nest egg build up at the same time that you would try to be maximizing your 401k. I mean, look, there's only so much money that you have available to you, right? You're
mm-hmm.
working hard, you're commuting. From my perspective, if you could figure out how to get yourself in a place where you're not doing that commute, it's also okay for you to say, maybe if your partner were to get a little bit better job and get some more pay
mm-hmm.
to say, you know, I don't want to manage this anymore. It's okay to spend a little bit more on your living arrangement. And I'm going to move
right.
to a nicer apartment on the east side for $1,000 a month because it's easier for me to live
right.
my life and have a little more joy. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It would be hard for me to justify to you, like, go ahead and kill yourself to buy a house because I'm not even sure to
right.
what end.
Right.
Have you and your partner, Jennifer, had conversations about what you want the next 5 years or 10 years to look like?
We do. We frequently have these conversations. I think that she's a little bit demoralized because she's applied to a lot of jobs and she's not getting anything. When we have those conversations, it's hard for her to imagine those 5 years. You know,
right.
all she can think of is, like, my goal is to get a job.
No, I understand.
First of all, you've done a great job of kickstarting your savings in retirement. So I think that's amazing. I really do. And I feel like I want to take you off the hook and say it's really okay not to own a house. It's okay if it works out that you can own a house, but I wouldn't make yourselves crazy pursuing that goal when you've got a lot of other stuff that's really moving in the right direction.
Right.
I'm letting you off the hook. I'm absolving you. Aunt Jill is absolving you right now.
That's, you know, that probably is exactly what I need.
Jennifer, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it. Will you keep us posted, please, and let us know what happens?
Absolutely. I totally will. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Of course. Take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
And stay with us. We're going to take a couple more retirement questions, including this one. Should you give a 401k as a romantic gift?
As my friend would like to say, it would fry my onions if you were putting money into his retirement and he wasn't.
And we check back in with a mom and daughter who called us a few weeks ago to help kickstart a conversation about college and money. So what happened next?
A funny thing that has happened as a side effect of this, I think, that Rebecca was all excited about her school ring, and we had to send in the deposit, and which we did. We sent it in, and she went, and they met with the representative, and he filled out all the papers about what she had ordered online. And then we get this text from Rebecca that says, OMG.
OMG. BRB. We'll be right back with that on Marketplace Money from APM. Our show on retirement generated a lot of questions from listeners. So today, my guest Jill Schlesinger is answering them. She's a CBS News business analyst and a regular contributor here. Our last caller is Sarah in Los Angeles. Thanks for calling, Sarah.
Thank you so much for taking my question. So I'm 26 and my boyfriend is about to turn 30. And I was thinking of gifts for him. And it occurred to me that if I was turning 30, I would really love it if someone gave me a retirement account.
That's so funny. That's great.
You know, put kind of a little chunk of money in there just to get it started. But he and I have very different financial habits. I'm worried that he will take it the wrong way. And I'm worried that it's kind of a mean gift to say, hey, you just turned 30, you should think about retirement because
you're
now
old.
Here's
some money.
Does he have a job?
He works full time, makes decent money.
So he does not contribute to a retirement plan through his job right now?
No, he doesn't contribute, I think, because they don't offer a matching contribution.
Before we get into your thoughts about your boyfriend, I'm going to have to big sister you. What do you do and are you saving for retirement?
I'm not. I just left a perfectly good full-time job to go to graduate school. So I was saving for school and living expenses, and now I'm taking out student loans to pay for my tuition.
All right, I'm going to unleash Jill on you because I have a feeling that while you may be thinking very generously toward your boyfriend, I suspect she wants you to think generously toward yourself.
That's right. I actually think that the gift of a retirement plan is a lovely idea, and it's not mean. It's totally awesome. You're not really in a position to make any sort of huge gift. Frankly, as my friend would like to say, it would fry my onions if you were putting money into his retirement and he wasn't.
Now, what if there was a plan available? I've looked at our credit union and they have something where you can make a starting contribution of only
$500. $500? What do you mean you're in debt? What kind of $500 present are you getting him? Come on. I'm worried about you. I mean, don't you need $500 to pay for school?
Of course I do. But I have to get him something.
I think you've demonstrated tremendous thoughtfulness in thinking about this and thinking about his future and thinking about someone who you want to have a future with. I also am curious about your own financial situation. After school or during school, you are in your 20s, the sort of miracles of compound interest that even those 4 years before you turn 30 make a big difference.
Yeah, and I almost would say that the best gift you could give him right now is to sit down with him in front of his computer and enroll him in his 401k. You could even say, like, I even thought about just doing this for you, but, you know, I called these two crazy chicks on the radio, and they said it would be better for you to do it yourself. And
now, can you give me a little primer on the 401k then? I mean, what?
Sure.
How do I explain the benefits of that to him?
You can sit down and you could say, well, this is how a 401k works. You get paid a dollar, and some portion of that dollar you can choose to put into a 401k. And the money that goes into the 401k does not get taxed. So there's a dual benefit. The amount of your taxable income is starting to drop, and as a result, your tax bill will go down. Number two, you're socking money away into an investment at age 30 that you hopefully won't touch for 30 or 40 years. And the fact that your company doesn't match is meaningless. I mean, that's just an extra benefit. You still have to save for retirement. And to do it in a tax-efficient way is a pretty awesome deal.
Okay.
Are you feeling steely and ready to do it?
Well, now I have to think of what else I could get him for his birthday.
Oh, no. I know. I've ruined it. What's his hobby? Let's pick a present for him right now. What's his hobby?
He is really into music.
So get some funny, you know, audiophile type of present. Spend, you know, maybe a couple $100 and sit down and give him the gift of his retirement by getting him to enroll in the 401k.
Yeah, you're in L.A. You can go to Amoeba, the greatest record store on the planet.
Yes, we could do that.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks so much.
Jill, I appreciate the tough love. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst for CBS News and the host of Jill on Money. Thank you very much for joining me.
It was so great to be with you.
And we'll check back in with Sarah soon to see how that conversation went. If you have a story or experience you want to share with us, or a possible birthday gift, you can visit marketplacemoney.org and click on the contact link. Last week on the show, we talked with Christian Spratt, a woman taking care of her aging grandparents. In the interview, there was an incorrect statement about Medicare. It's Medicaid where income eligibility matters, and we wanted to correct that. Lots of you also wrote in to offer suggestions on what Christian might do. Many of her options and those for other caregivers depend on different state laws. Taking care of a loved one can be confusing, legally, emotionally, and financially. Catherine Pearson, a professor at Penn State's Dickinson School of Law, says know what programs are available to you.
Medicare is a federally directed health insurance for older adults. Generally speaking, it covers hospital care and doctor's visits, but it also provides some important transition services between hospital and home, and it can cover up to 100 days of skilled care, plus some home health care and hospice. There are no asset or income restrictions. It often involves premiums, deductibles, and copays. The separate program, Medicaid, is a means-tested benefits program. So we're going to be looking at income and resources or assets. Medicaid does have less strict medical necessity rules, and it is probably the major payer for long-term care services. And therefore, people do need to be aware of both programs when we're talking about family care.
Professor Pearson also had some tips about how to find local services and get support when you're a caregiver.
First of all, I would look to my AAA office. What's a AAA office? Well, that's an area agency on aging. Sometimes it's called community or county aging services. But it's a government office, a local government office, and they're often going to be able to be a great source of information about programs available in your state, as well as actual physical resources such as home care support services in your county.
We've got a list of resources for caregivers on our website, marketplacemoney.org. This is Marketplace Money from APM. As part of our American Dream series, we talked about how to pay for college. That included a conversation with personal finance expert Michelle Singletary and a family in Mississippi. Catherine and her teenage daughter Rebecca got a little gentle talking to from Michelle because they hadn't sat down to discuss the cost of college. Catherine and Rebecca promised us that that talk was going to be on their Labor Day lunch menu, so we're checking back in with them. Catherine, Rebecca, welcome back to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Hello.
Catherine, when we last spoke, you said you were going to spend Labor Day weekend having barbecue ribs and talking financial aid. What happened?
Well, we did exactly that, actually. We talked about it at the Labor Day lunch table, and it was really good conversation. It kind of went all over the place. We talked about why we chose to take on the debt for Sarah's education at Tulane.
So Sarah's your older daughter, right?
Correct. She's the one that is graduating soon and the one that we actually do have college debt with. But it was a choice we made that we knew we were going to have to do this for her to go to this school that she wanted to go to and that was so good for her. We talked a little bit, too, I guess, about how one of the comments you made about good debt and bad debt. And even though the expert kind of said, well, but it's all debt, as a family, we agreed with you that, you know, there is a certain amount of good debt that you can take on as long as it doesn't get out of hand.
Yeah, I don't want, you're going to get me in trouble with Michelle.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But, you know, you know, in an ideal world, it would be great if I could have put money aside for all four kids. But at the time, I had four children under the age of 12. Actually under the age of 11, and there was just simply no way that I could possibly, from a one-income family, do something like that.
Rebecca, what did you come away from that Labor Day conversation thinking?
Well, before we talked about it, I guess I can say I hadn't really given much thought to college, but ever since we had it, I have been thinking about my options and where I could go. We discussed a little bit about how my parents wanted me to stay relatively close and not go somewhere we couldn't afford. So I've been thinking about what options that leaves me.
That was a roundabout way, Rebecca. Yeah, essentially, you know, we talked to her about that we chose to do that debt with Sarah because she was wanting to go into pharmacy school. And we felt like that was good debt for her chosen career. So Rebecca, at this point, when she decides what she wants to do, she may not be ready. And so if she's not ready to make that commitment to a certain career path, then it would make a lot of sense for her to stay here, to stay locally. And we kind of wish Sarah now had done that in hindsight.
Rebecca, how do you feel about that when you think about what it would mean to carry debt after graduation? I gather you listened to this segment after yours where you heard a guy with about $100,000 in debt.
That was a big part of the conversation.
Yeah,
on that table.
We did talk about the other people that were interviewed and how we would not want to carry a bunch of debt off of college. I'm kind of nervous thinking about financial costs of going to college and what it could mean in the future.
Did it change what you want to do?
It is definitely something to consider.
Yeah, it's all going to depend on what she thinks she wants to do.
Did you guys have any disagreements when you sat down and had that conversation?
I can say that my mom, she was kind of wanting me to stay local, and I'm not sure that that is something I would want to do, to stay so close to home when there's so many places I could go.
And truthfully, I don't think we disagreed because, to be fair, I have to give her a lot of the options that I've given the other children. It's just that in this case, I think I will ask her to consider staying close to save the money, but don't tell her. I'll let her, you know.
She can hear you.
I will let her know that, you know, we will discuss options.
Rebecca, you've started your junior year of school, right?
Yes.
So are you getting brochures and things about colleges in the mail?
Yes, there have been a lot of
people speaking for colleges that have come to talk to us and recruit people to go to their schools. And it's almost overwhelming to think of how many options that we all have.
Yeah, Lizzie, one of the things that I can point out here is that over that same dinner table, we were talking about school rings. And this is really kind of a funny thing that has happened as a side effect of this, I think, that Rebecca was all excited about her school ring, and we had to send in the deposit, and which we did. We sent it in, and she went, and they met with the representative, and he filled out all the papers about what she had ordered online. And then we get this text from Rebecca that says, OMG, the amount of the ring is going to be this amount, and that's way too much. And so she all of a sudden became very conscious, and she told us to call him and tell him that she didn't need that big of a ring. She didn't need something that cost that much. And she's starting to be aware of maybe a little bit of excessiveness is not necessary.
Rebecca, Catherine, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. Keep us posted, okay, on how it goes.
We certainly will. Thank you.
Thank you.
At its core, personal finance is about conversations like that, the one between Catherine and her daughter Rebecca. Yeah, it's about money, how you save, spend, and invest, but it's also about asking yourself what works and what doesn't, like when Mike shared with us the story about the cost of his investment account.
Management fee about 1.5%. And it runs about $4,000 a year or so.
Yeah, you've got about $250,000 in there. You've got a fair amount of money to work with. I can see Liz moving around in her chair. I know she's got opinions. All right, go ahead, Liz.
Is this advisor detailing your car and doing your taxes and making your estate plan?
No, but probably should be, right?
Yes. I am so glad you're thinking about this now, because here's the thing. Those fees will really get you, and I'm sure that's what you heard in the previous program.
And most experts, including Liz Weston, say check those fees closely. Is the advice you're getting worth the cost? Then there's the conversation about owning a home. Mortgage rates are inching up, and people wonder, should I get in now?
We've seen a bounce from 3.5% to 4.5%, which is very scary if you're thinking of buying. But historically, anything below 6% is still a very low mortgage rate. I wouldn't use the rise in rates as a reason to be too hasty in my decision.
That's Allison Rogers. She's a real estate agent. And she also says if you're interested in buying, ask your agent to walk you through homes that have recently sold where you're looking. That way you can get a sense of price and value. And here's one other thing you need to remember. No price is set in stone. Even when it comes to medical bills, you get a bill for service, but you can negotiate. Just ask this question.
Can I just pay this in cash up front? It might be worth working out a payment plan, asking if you can pay the bill in smaller installments over a matter of years. If you can work out a plan where you can pay it with no interest or very little interest over time, that might be more doable for a lot of people.
That's Jen Viechner, and she's a writer for The Wall Street Journal and Market Watch. We have a summary of all those tips, plus some more, across topics that we've covered the last few weeks on this show: homeownership, retirement, college savings, student debt, and healthcare. Just go to marketplacemoney.org and click on the American Dream link at the top of the page. That's it for Marketplace Money this week. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplacemoney.org or on our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, a personal finance grudge match. Roth IRA versus a 529 savings account. What's the best way to save for college?
If you're kind of struggling to find enough money to save for both college and retirement, or if you're not sure if your kids are going to go to college or not, a Roth is a good way to save.
We'll break them down so you can decide. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch and Nancy Fragali, with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Daryl Perinata. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening, everyone.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the Subscribe to Podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.